But to do this, I need to tell you some past history about my encounter with the Delphine Shield. In the summer of 1973, while living in Eugene, Oregon, Ken and I decided to use an IUD for birth control. My doctor tells me I cannot use the pill as I have high blood pressure, so the Delphine Shield IUD is my best option. The Delphine Shield was advertised as a safe method of birth control for women who hadn't been pregnant before. Ken and I decided to go ahead and get the Delphine Shield as we both want to finish college before we had children. In July and August of 1974, I became extremely sick with a pelvic inflammatory disease with a high temperature. After several months, the doctor got the infection under control. During the rest of 1974, I did not feel very well and had long periods that last about 14 days. I felt really drained and this didn't help my performance in college. In the summer of 1975, because my body won't tolerate the IUD, my doctor decided that the IUD had to be removed. I assumed the Delphine Shield was still okay and relied on the information given to me when I purchased it. My doctor tells me about a new type of pill for people with high blood pressure. He also tells me I should have a short wait to have a child once I start taking the pill. Early in 1978, we decide the time is right to plan our family. In August of 1979, after waiting 19 months, I still don't have any children. After consulting with my doctor, he refers us to a fertility specialist. In 1979, after several fertility tests, the specialist did a lab scope to see what condition my tubes were in. He found that my tubes had adhesions. He suggests two major surgeries to remove the adhesions and hopefully correct the problem. By February 1980, my major surgeries are complete. In June 1981, I still have not become pregnant. I see another specialist who suggests hormone treatment. This wasn't successful, so I suggest another lab scope to see the conditions of my tubes. In 1981, news coverage came out about women who had suffered problems from the Delphine Shield. I'm astounded how similar my case is to women who were injured by the Delphine Shield. It now has been over 8 years since my purchase of the Delphine Shield. It wasn't clear till late 1981 that my problems could be associated with the IUD. When I go and pursue my case against the company who manufactured the Delphine Shield, I find that I can't because of the 8-year statute of limitations. My problem was not an obvious problem, and I want to stress I trusted the information from the manufacturer of the Delphine Shield. In July of 1983, I have a final lab scope, and to my regret, my tubes are still damaged. This ends my history, but doesn't end the trauma. I've had extensive counseling to deal with my infertility. My husband and I have joined a waiting list to adopt a baby, which involves lots of time and money. Please pass House Bill 2510. This would be a small step in getting my case presented in a court of law, but really, can you put a dollar amount on a child my husband and I will never have?
Okay, thank you. Let me ask you a couple of things. Now, you were attending the university at the time of the...
Lane Community College.
Lane Community College. And was, did you have this the IUD prescribed by your own private physician or by... a hospital or by the health service on the campus or what?
Well, it's Planned Parenthood.
Pardon?
Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood, okay. Where do you live now?
I live in Salem.
Did you say that you started the suit and that you were cut out because of this?
No, I didn't file a suit because I didn't realize my problems could be even related to this topic.
Okay.
News coverage.
Any other questions of Mrs. Luetag? Is that the way you pronounce it?
Yes.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks very much, both of you. Thank you. Now, is Carol Hewitt. Carol Hewitt, please.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Carol Hewitt. I'm an attorney in Portland with the Lindsay Hart Neal and Weigler firm. One of my clients is the A.H. Robbins Company, which is the manufacturer of the Delphine Shield. I have written testimony to present today on House Bill 2510. I'm also filing written testimony by a gentleman by the name of Ron Cotella, who I don't believe is here, at least I didn't see him when I started, who is giving testimony on behalf of the James Insurance Group and was subpoenaed this morning to go to court on another matter in Portland, so I don't think he's able to be down here.
I have a Ron Cotella that signed up on the witness.
All right, we'll see if he's here after I finish my testimony,
okay.
But I had some doubts as to whether he could come.
All right, she signed.
I wrote his name down on the witness list because I wasn't sure whether he was coming or not.
Okay.
I'd like to address a number of the matters that were raised by Mr. Williams and some other matters which are contained in my written testimony. I disagree with Mr. Williams' statement that the amendment which House Bill 2510 would make with respect to IUDs is similar to that for asbestosis, which was made last time. The comprehensive statute of limitations bill that was passed in 1977 and became ORS 30.905 was intended to put an outer time limit on all claims brought on all products. An exception was made for asbestosis in the last session of the legislature for reasons which relate to the peculiar nature of asbestosis. The latency period is 30 to 40 years, as Mr. Williams noted, which is certainly not the same with the pelvic inflammatory disease, which is the primary claim of people who sue on the use of IUDs. Secondly, there is no provision in the asbestosis statute for refiling of cases which are already dismissed. I do not know of a single jurisdiction anywhere in the United States or anywhere in the world which has such a provision in it which would allow cases which have already been through the courts and been resolved years ago to be refiled and resurrected in court.
I have a question.
Yes, Senator.
But there's no prohibition on the legislature doing that.
I think there probably is. I think it's unconstitutional. I think it's probably well, there are two reasons why I think this bill is unconstitutional related to IUDs. The first is this retroactivity clause being a violation of the due process of the manufacturers who already have litigated an issue at one time.
But they haven't litigated the merits of the issue.
No, but they have litigated a case and it's been dismissed with prejudice. The second reason I think it's illegal is that it is product specific. And Mr. Williams addressed the term IUDs, but he is really addressing the Dalcon Shield, and that is what the other witnesses here have addressed. That's what the newspaper articles that he has put in addressed. I don't think he makes any bones about the fact that this is a special purpose bill that has been introduced by a lawyer who has tried these cases and has had them dismissed. He's in effect lost in the courts and is now trying to come in and refile cases which he has a personal financial interest in against the Dalcon Shield, which certainly is not illegal, but I'm saying it's product specific and the legislative history clearly shows that.
Senator Hendrickson?
Well, isn't asbestos sort of a specific type of substance, and we have specific legislation and specific remedies for victims of that particular product?
Asbestosis is a chemical product. IUDs in general are a specific medical device, but the Dalcon Shield is brand name specific. So this bill is much more product specific than asbestosis, which is a generic type of chemical and of course manufactured by any number of different manufacturing companies. Mr. Williams referred in his testimony to women who have used IUDs.
I would just say I really don't see the difference. I think it's a reasonable classification of the legislature.
All right, finish.
All right, go ahead. Finish then. Let me proceed.
Mr. Williams testified that women who have used the Dalcon Shield are victims. I disagree with that statement. The Dalcon Shield is a medical device. Like all medical devices and all medical products, it has risks and it has benefits associated with its use. In 1972, Robbins put in its labeling of this product that one of the possible side effects of its use is pelvic inflammatory disease, just as one of the side effects of the birth control pill is high blood pressure, stroke, and even death. It is generally known in the scientific community, and always has been, that there are benefits and risks associated with each product. It is up to the individual doctor prescribing it, and it must be prescribed by a doctor. It's not available over the counter. It's up to that doctor to determine whether the benefits outweigh the risk in the use of a particular product. And they may differ with respect to different products, but it is certainly a scientific question which is left up to the doctor. There is no doubt that there are some scientific studies today showing that there is a slightly increased risk of pelvic infection with all IUDs. Pelvic infection occurs in somewhere between 2% and 4% of all women of reproductive age every year. It is not a disease which is unique to the use of IUDs by any means, and it is not a disease which is caused by IUDs. Just like there are some associations in medical science between coffee drinking and high blood pressure, which may or may not be causative. There's an increased risk in some studies between the use of all IUDs and pelvic infection. That does not make the person who uses it a victim. It does not make the product effective, and it does not make it unreasonable either for a manufacturer to make the product or for a doctor to prescribe it or for a woman to use it. I'm not going to defend on the merits today the claims that are being made because that is not really the issue before the legislature, but I would like to point out that approximately 50% of all the cases that have been tried in the courts on their merits on the Dalkon Shield have resulted in defense verdicts. So it is certainly a question on which one can argue both sides as to whether there is or should be any ultimate liability. With respect to the issue of a reserve, Robbins has created an accounting reserve, which is simply that. They have said that they anticipate expenses on cases that they lose to be as high as possibly $615 million over a period of many years. 2.8 million of these products, of these Dalkon Shields, were sold domestically. If you anticipate a rate of 2 to 4% of pelvic infection among these women, you can anticipate that at least 60,000 women who use the Dalkon Shield will have pelvic infections, and a great many of those have sued because of adverse publicity. So Robbins realistically has anticipated this amount as their possible liability. That does not mean they have created a fund of money. There is no money created by this. There is no money set aside as a result of it. It is simply an accounting entry which is necessary in order to anticipate the likelihood of incurring expenses in the future. In order to be paid, the woman must of course file a lawsuit or assert a claim and have it either settled or tried, the same way as with any other kind of products liability action. There's nothing unique about there being any funds available to pay people as a result of this reserve. The entire purpose of the statute of limitations on products liability is to give certainty to manufacturers, sellers, and insurers of products so that they can anticipate and know what their risks are going to be. Now, obviously, that can't be done completely because when a manufacturer puts a product on the market, they not only don't know how many are going to be sold, they don't know all of the possible ramifications, no matter how tested that product is going to be. However, a great deal of testimony was presented to the legislature when they adopted 30.905 to indicate that it is in the best interest generally of the public to have a known certain period during which claims can be asserted. The reason for that pervades products liability, construction law, real estate, contracts, and any other area of the law. It becomes virtually impossible for litigants to bring forth the facts surrounding something when it's 10 or 15 years after the fact. It's already difficult enough in these cases involving IUDs when medical records are routinely destroyed by doctors after a number of years. Information is simply not available from which it can even be established whether or not the particular manufacturer being sued was the one who made the product. The public policy reason for statutes of limitations applies here as it does in everything else, and the fact that there are people who will be outside of that time period is inevitable, unfortunate, but inevitable in any area of the law. The arguments which you've heard in favor of this bill today can be asserted in favor of every other kind of product and every other area of the law when somebody has not brought suit within the time period. Contrary to what Mr. Williams said, Oregon is not in a unique situation. There are other states which have statutes of limitations. Virtually every state has one. The question of whether it's longer or shorter than Oregon's varies from state to state. There are some that are shorter, there are some that are longer. There are some countries that have statutes of limitations which totally bar any kind of products actions after 6 or 8 or 10 years. It's the norm in the judicial system for there to be such limitation periods, not the norm to have them be open-ended periods of time. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, did Mr. Cotella ever show up? Okay. All right, that's, let's see now. Oh, I'm sorry, is there somebody that I didn't call on? Okay, I'm sorry, yes indeed. Sit right down here. I guess the reason I didn't notice your name was because it was the first one on the list.
Right. I'm Renita Cornwell, representing the Women's Rights Coalition. Reproductive rights is a priority issue for the coalition, and we consider the availability of safe, effective birth control to be an aspect of reproductive rights. We support House Bill 2510, which would make it possible for women injured by intrauterine devices to file civil actions for up to 2 years after discovery of inner injury. Oregon law currently bars any claim for injuries after 8 years from the first use of a product, no matter whether the manufacturer recommended use of a device for more than 8 years, and no matter whether a woman can prove a fraudulent cover-up of adverse effects of the product or gross negligence in its development or testing. The Oregon statute of repose is one of the most restrictive laws of its kind in the nation. The intrauterine device, or IUD, which has caused the most problems for women, is of course the Dalkin Shield. A woman who wore this device for 8 years or more, a device not recalled by its manufacturer until October of 1984, 13 years after it was first marketed, and then suffered injury, cannot take her claim to court in Oregon, though she could in most other states. Injuries blamed on the Dalkin Shield and the more than 12,000 claims filed nationwide include serious pelvic infections, miscarriages, conceptions resulting in birth defective children, complete infertility, hysterectomies, and death. The question is asked, why create an exception for IUDs? We believe the legacy of the Dalkin Shield is an exceptional situation. No other birth control method, and perhaps no other drug or device used by American women, has been blamed for such widespread suffering. Necessity for and use of birth control is a fact of life for most American women. Surveys show women assume the responsibility for birth control in most sexually active relationships. A woman relying on a birth control method places in it not only her belief that it will prevent pregnancy, but her trust that it will not injure her body. For the dozens of American women who believe they suffered permanent injury from the Dalkin Shield, passage of House Bill 2510 will not guarantee redress, but will at least ensure that an accident of residency will not prevent them from having the same opportunity as women in other states to file their claims. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thanks for being here. I don't think I missed anybody else. So that'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2510. And we'll go to House Bill 2638. 2638.
Is there a staff analysis of 2510?
Yeah, are we going to be able to have a
group
session?
No, we're not going to have a group session.
Is it you in the House staff analysis?
The last of
the two that we've done on the schedule here.
We started doing that in about the last 30 days.
Okay, let's see now. I've got two witnesses on 2638. Jack, come on up. You fellows are on opposite sides of this, but I guess you can get along together, there, can't you?
We've already talked about it, Senator.
We've already talked about it. Okay, let's see. Since this is the request of the American Civil Liberties Union, Mr. House, we'll let you go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Stephen House, an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I'm here as a cooperating attorney on behalf of the ACLU, which has requested this bill be introduced in the legislature. Very briefly, what this bill is designed to accomplish is to bring those Oregon statutes which are affected concerning the use of deadly force by peace officers into conformity with the recent United States Supreme Court decision, Tennessee versus Garner. That case, as I'm sure some of the members are familiar with, changed the law with respect to peace officers being able to use deadly physical force with unarmed and fleeing felons of any description. And essentially, the court ruled that to take the life of a person by the use of deadly physical force is a seizure under the terms of the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And as such, that analysis required that the police officer have probable cause to believe, and I'll read very briefly, essentially the heart of that opinion from the Supreme Court. The court indicated where the officer has probable cause to believe that the suspect poses a threat of serious physical harm, either to the officer or to others, it is not constitutionally unreasonable to prevent escape by using deadly force. Thus, if the suspect threatens the officer with a weapon, where there is probable cause to believe he has committed a crime involving the infliction or threatened infliction of serious physical harm, deadly force may be used if necessary to prevent the escape, and if where feasible, some warning has been given. So what we have done here is change the wording of several applicable statutes under the Oregon Code of Criminal Procedure relating to this. And with the exception of several bits of language, the bill as presently before this committee is in a fashion that is supportable by the ACLU. The changes that I would suggest to the committee are the following. At line 6 and 7 of the bill itself, it reads, "The officer reasonably believes," in two pertinent sections. And you'll notice that in all other places, the language that is used is "the officer has probable cause to believe." I believe that in order for this bill to be brought into conformity with the United States Supreme Court decision, which is, of course, the minimum constitutional standard that must be met by any state, including Oregon, the language should be probable cause all throughout rather than reasonably believes. Reasonably believes, in my opinion, is a standard that can be construed to be less than that quantum of evidence necessary to constitute probable cause. Probable cause is a term that's defined in the criminal code and is used in the field of both search and seizure and arrest. Under those concepts, it, of course, would then track with the U.S. Supreme Court decision. There has been an amendment made with respect to that the warning portion that is at the I believe lines 23 and 24, and after the second comma there has been inserted by the House the phrase "some warning has been given," deleting the original portion of the language, which was specific that the officer would tell the person to cease engaging in some kind of conduct. I support that amendment. I think that makes sense. It's very clear language. At the risk of speaking for Mr. Frost, I believe the only serious area of disagreement, frankly, is one of a basic public policy nature, and that has to do with whether the legislature wishes to establish a standard for law enforcement personnel by this statute that unequivocally states a legal standard, that is probable cause, a legal standard by which an officer must judge the use or non-use of deadly physical force. It is the position of the ACLU that such a policy decision is a wise one, in addition to the fact that we believe it's constitutionally now required as a result of the Supreme Court's decision.
Well, we don't need this statute because we've got a U.S. Supreme Court decision that tells us that everything, but you're saying that even if we don't need it, it ought to be in the books.
I think so, Senator, frankly, because this legislature has, both in the Criminal Law Revision Commission that Mr. Frost knows far more about than probably anyone alive, attempted to codify a great deal of the decisional law, both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Oregon Supreme Court. And frankly, from a standpoint of the economy of effort of both litigants, judges, and law enforcement officers, it makes a great deal of sense to have a handy reference rather than resort to case decision in the form of a statute that clearly lays out the rule of what is expected of the law enforcement officer and what the citizenry of the state can expect in terms of their conduct as well.
All right. Any questions of Mr. House? Senator Simmons.
How much time does a police officer have to make the decision and give the warning when it's necessary to use force?
In many cases, of course, it differs from situation to situation. In my experience as a criminal defense attorney for a dozen years or so now, you see it all over the ballpark. That's why the language is inserted where feasible. There will obviously be situations in which an officer will have to make an instantaneous judgment. And this bill and its language is not intended in any sense to second-guess that. It allows for that.
When do you think such a warning might be feasible?
I'm sorry?
When do you think such a warning might be feasible?
A situation, for example, in which a person is fleeing, a foot chase kind of thing, is very common with police officers in a city environment where they're chasing someone fleeing from a vehicle on foot. And there's a question, a reasonable question, perhaps, in the mind of the officer as to whether the individual is armed or presents some immediate threat of deadly physical force to himself or another person present. The bill contemplates a reasonable application of the use of physical force, whether it's deadly or any other, and it's common sense, and I think it is, in fact, the standard practice in virtually every police department throughout the state, that officers do not and are not trained to readily resort to the use of deadly physical force. They use sound judgment. If you can dissuade a person, even armed, from using that weapon, they do it. If, however, you're faced with a situation where that's frankly not possible, you don't have time to discuss the matter, then the officer's sound judgment is what will prevail. What we're suggesting here is only that now that the Supreme Court has enunciated a clear legal standard, a workable rule for all of us to understand, whether it's a law enforcement person or a citizen or a judge or a lawyer, we should say it. As a legislative body, it should become part of the enacted Criminal Code of Oregon. The standard we had before, I think, is ambiguous at best, and is now not sufficient to meet the constitutional standards set by our Supreme Court.
Mr. Chair, at least you're not suggesting that the officer and the person who is threatening him sit down and say, well, now, really, you shouldn't use deadly force on me because I'm just a poor, misguided child, and the officer shouldn't say yes, but I might have to if you don't do something. You're not suggesting that kind of a warning.
Absolutely not. I think there has been seen in this state as well as in others a general decrease in the use of deadly physical force, other means being used as the training standards and qualifications of law enforcement have risen. This bill, I do not believe, does any violence to that. It will not create an environment in which police officers or other citizens will be jeopardized. In fact, it will promote public safety, both that of police officers and individuals.
Is deadly physical force defined?
Deadly physical force is not defined in this particular statute. Deadly physical force is otherwise defined in the code.
Do you happen to know how it's defined?
I'm sorry?
Do you happen to know how it is defined?
Well, deadly physical force is defined as such force as readily capable of inflicting serious physical injury or death upon the individual. It's found in 161.015. Physical force that under circumstances in which it is used is readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury.
One more question. And readily capable, would you say that the so-called chokehold or carotid hold is a deadly physical force?
Well, I happen to be the attorney defending Portland police officer Gary Barber, who is the focus of that inquiry. And that matter is something fairly close to my attention. The review of the carotid restraint hold is ongoing. I am aware of other jurisdictions that have concluded, other police departments that have concluded, that the carotid restraint hold is such a degree of force and in certain circumstances can have unpredictable enough results that it should be classified as deadly physical force. There is not unanimity of agreement on that subject, however.
I was looking at the word readily, which implies it wouldn't happen every time, probably.
I think that there is general agreement that deadly physical force is that degree of force commonly associated with the use of a firearm for law enforcement. Degrees of force typically employed by police as they escalate in their degree of seriousness have as their sole deadly force area defined the use of a firearm.
Thank you. Senator Hendrickson.
No, that's right.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I was not aware that it assumed a weapon.
All right. Jack?
For the record, my name is Jack Frost. I'm the district attorney from Linn County, and sometimes I'm sorry to say I have been for 17 years.
Are you the senior now, Jack?
No, I think Bill Wallace from Curry County has an edge on me because he was elected 6 months before I was appointed, Senator. Mm-hmm. At any rate, it's true, as Mr. Hauser states, I was very much involved when the original of 161-239, which is now in the books, was enacted. I want to recount for you very briefly that there was quite a bit of discussion about it at the time. There was, I remember, Senator Ituri was one of the mainsprings in that, and Senator Carson, now his honor. And it's always been a sort of controversial thing. I want to also recount for you that this is about the first state session that I've appeared on behalf of law enforcement and ODAA in response to bills filed by ACLU. The previous bills were defeated at one point or another. It didn't get onto the floor of one of the houses. But I must confess to you that they have a point now, because in April of 1985, Supreme Court handed down their opinion in the case of Tennessee versus Garner. I hope counsel has the Attorney General's memorandum of his analysis of that opinion and also a copy of the opinion. If you do not, I would glad to provide it to you.
Okay, we don't have it, Jackson.
Okay, I'll get it to you. The first thing I think I want to say about this statute is that one of my differences with the position taken by ACLU over these last five sessions, regardless of the specific wording of the language, is that there's some hope that this is going to change how officers react on the moment. Senators, I don't think anything on the statute, as Senator Simmons has alluded to in questioning Mr. Hauser, don't really make that much difference, because I think the typical situation is that the officer, when he goes to the point of using deadly force, doesn't have much time to think about what you folks may have put down on the book or even what the Supreme Court had to say. I suggest to you, in my experience, and I've personally investigated, been on the scene within a half hour or so, two different instances in my 17 years where an officer had indeed killed someone who was suspected of being a felon. They're tragic situations from both points of view, don't misunderstand me. And I'm saying that when you're actually there, you realize that typically the officer is faced with some god-awful decisions to make in a very short period of time. And the first point I want to
It's interesting that the facts are that it was a nonviolent crime that the guy had been accused of committing. It's a simple burglary without weapons.
Mr. Chairman, I'm persuaded by Senator Failey. I think that in looking at the language of the bill, that's probably exactly what you're intending. It's because when you look at the probable cause of language modifies to believe a crime has been committed or believe he's inflicting or threatened to inflict serious physical injury, whereas the reasonable belief is believe whether you need to use the force or not.
I can't say. The only thing I wanted to add in is two things. Number one, in a pre-hearing discussion among the interested parties, reasonable belief, the reasonableness rather than the probable cause standard was put on the draft of the bill we were going to put in the committee. It came out of the committee this way, and I can't explain it. The other thing I wanted to say...
Well, we've got to define the intent of the House, then, don't we, here?
Yeah, I think so. And I can't help you, Senator. The other thing I want to say to Senator Feldman, I think your analysis, I don't disagree with your analysis, except that behind that, the whole premise the Supreme Court came from in starting out to use the word probable cause is just as Steve said, that they started on an analysis of seizure, that the taking of the life was the seizure of the body. And so what you're saying may or may not fit, because I'm not too sure that that's where the Supreme Court was coming from when they finally got down and later on used probable cause again.
Okay, any other questions on the committee? Ted, did you have anything to add? You didn't you?
Mr. Chair,
you did.
Just a tiny bit. The politic of the whole thing, if I may. Not the legal of the whole thing. The bill is before your committee today. Ted Hughes, representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon Peace Officers Association. The bill is before your committee today because law enforcement met maybe 7 or 8 times, deliberated this whole subject, our probable cause, reasonably believed. Quite frankly, I was involved in it all. Quite frankly, I can't find anybody invested in mind in the world to tell me why they believe that probable cause is a higher degree of responsibility than reasonably believed. I still don't feel comfortable. I don't see the difference between those two, and I've listened to the debate, and no one's told me to turn to the ORS, and that there will be the fine. So, our people, the Attorney General interpreted the U.S. Supreme Court decision. We have this April 4th.
Now, you're leaving a copy of that for the committee?
I delivered it to the court. I got both a copy of the opinion and a copy of the Attorney General's memorandum.
Okay. So, my people said we will go along with a revision of the deadly force law insofar as it parallels and as closely as possible the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, and only that far. Now, the debate has been, does it go further, does it not go far enough? I believe that should the bill be amended into the probable cause area, and maybe perhaps Mr. Hauser's right. I don't disagree with what he said. Maybe the whole thing ought to read that. Law enforcement would probably pull away from their support and, as a matter of fact, go on the aggressive against the bill. Right now, I don't think, I guess what I'm saying, we can change a comma or a period and expect law enforcement's continued support in the area. And the way it happened in the House was that we all agreed that reasonably bleeds ought to be in A and probable cause ought to be in B and C because nobody could read the final correctly. So I guess I'm urging the committee, if you're going to change anything, that it, in keeping with the chairman's suggestion, reasonably bleeds makes my people feel better, but they don't know why.
You want to leave the bill alone?
Yes, sir.
I think that's where I'm at. I wouldn't advise the bank to do it.
Mr. Hughes, if I may, speaks for a certain group.
Okay.
The group I speak for is not as happy as he makes it sound.
Senator Hennessy.
Well, I think they'd all agree what we want to codify is the standard, Supreme Court standard, if we can ascertain what that is.
Yes.
Yeah. They really don't speak to all of it, and they do say if it's an unarmed burglary, you better not shoot him.
Well, the only thing I want to say for myself, or for, let's say, just the DAs, is I want to remind the chairman, who I know has been in that position, that the place where this statute is really going to count is when that report's put in front of me that a shooting's taking place and I'm going to have to decide whether or not to pursue a prosecution of an officer. I want to know which way you're coming, reasonable cause or reasonable or probable cause.
Well, I think that the officer needs a high standard to believe that person he might shoot is a suspect of a crime. That needs a slightly lower standard to decide to use the force when he's determining how great the threat of injury to himself or to a third party is. The identity of the potential target as a felon who has used force or may use force, being sure you've got that relationship straight, you ought to be more sure of that so you don't get a mistaken identity shooting. I come around the corner of the building and we're hearing two shots. A person's lying there with a full of blood and another person is holding a gun. The person looks at me like this and turns the hand for me. I don't know what I do, but I'm not yet sure that's the one that shot that person.
I understand.
But if he shoots at me, then I haven't got much question.
Or time.
You know why? He has a serious design on my life and safety. And there I don't expect it as good a high standard.
Appreciate the record. I may need to use it.
Senator, anybody else have any questions?
I only remark that Senator Fatale didn't have much time to make that decision either when the man starts shooting at him.
Right, and that is running like a record in my head. We don't expect the same level of judgment where there's extreme stress as we would where there's another patrol car two blocks down the street that might head off this guy going up over the fence.
Let me make one final observation just to tie it together if I can before we finish, and that is that we're talking about judgment calls, real life, on the street judgment calls. They happen every single day. They happen in the use of force, deadly force, decisions to arrest, decisions to search and seize. Police officers are trained to do these things. No one is infallible. We recognize that. It's human judgment. We need a consistent standard that everyone understands. Probable cause is used as the standard when a police officer decides to arrest you on a drunk driving ticket. Now, it seems ironic, to say the least, that we would suggest that a lesser standard would be appropriate constitutionally to allow a police officer to resort to deadly physical force. Take a life. Reasonable belief there, probable cause to arrest on a drunk drive. I think the consistency is mandated by the U.S. Supreme Court because they say probable cause means a seizure of the person, whether you physically take them, physically take their property, or physically take their life by the use of the deadly physical force. Same standard should apply.
I know we can learn more from the witnesses than we can from the committee members, but don't you see a difference between the legal issue of trying to determine when the government is entitled to do something and the practical jury issue of self-defense or defense of another?
The If I understand your question correctly, I think if the matter were presented as hindsight review of the conduct of a police officer in a given situation, it would be construed in the light of a reasonable person under those circumstances then and there existing, whether you call it probable cause or something else. But you've got to have a consistent standard, if for no other reason than for the protection of the police officer. If the police officer thinks that he can resort to deadly physical force, if he's just got some belief he thinks is reasonable, we might all look at it and very well decide that's not very reasonable.
Let me try one more time. The police officer is just a fellow in danger when he's getting shot at.
Right.
The police officer is an arm of the government when he shoots a guy running away from him going over the fence.
Right. Probable cause simply means more likely than not. Probable cause in the case of the person presenting a threat of physical injury or death to you, more likely than not? That's not an unworkable standard, I would suggest, Senator. And I think it's a reasonable one, and more importantly, our Supreme Court has said it is the standard. We can all discuss it until tomorrow morning, but they've told us what it is, and I think that's what we're really all finally bound by, and I just suggest we enact it as a statutory standard in Oregon as well, for clarification.
All right. 12 seconds, Jack.
Okay. Reasonable belief is the standard throughout Oregon statutes on justification. If you make probable cause in there, you're doing something different. That's the
only
point.
Now, here's what I think. I don't think that the world's going to come to an end if this bill doesn't get out of legislature. There's not a whole lot of time left. Maybe you guys ought to get together and see if there's any way you can come up with something that's mutually agreeable.
I like one of Bacon's maxims, but we've slid back from that in 1600. It basically says that you cannot take another life until there's absolute certainty there's no other way to do it. We aren't in that position here. I truly think the difference between being sure you're right, he's the guy you want, and a lesser standard of being sure whether you're really in danger yourself is a justifiable way to describe the bill and the amount.
I just had a great point about describing this section without looking at the whole section of justification.
That's why I wrote up Baker's
maxims. Senator Fry, I'll take the chair's suggestion and speak with both other witnesses and see if there is any.
All right, why don't you do that and then kind of let the staff know if there's any.
Thank
all right,
you.
Thanks
Thank
very
you.
Much for your.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2638. Now, we've got a closed session. In 3 o'clock, and there's no sense in our deluding ourselves into thinking they're not going to need us there, because pretty soon, if we're not down there, they're going to send a sergeant arms up, because they can't hardly get a quorum now with all those committees. So to the committee members, I suggest we just break here and get started down there, and those of us who can come back, come back. So at 2:58, I'm going to declare this committee in recess. Let me tell the people in the audience that at least one member of this committee as a subcommittee will be back at the first opportunity, and it's my intention to get through. I'd like to get through everything today if I have to sit here by myself, but you'll just have to be patient. That's all there is to it. We'll take up probably take up 2795 next, because we've got a couple of folks from a long way away, and I don't want to hold you over too late. Okay? That's it.